Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal. I'm Meredith DeFrancesco here with co-host Amy Brown. Today we'll be talking with the main activist who has been attending the Barry Cherney FBI trial in California. But first we have this update from Valerie Carter of BayCord, Bangor Area Citizens Organized for Responsible Development, the group that has been fighting the proposed Walmart development in the ecologically sensitive Panjajawak Marsh in Bangor. Recently, the developer has proposed conservation easements, which they say will mitigate the environmental damage the development would have on the marsh. BayCord disagrees, and Valerie Carter is here to tell us why. Welcome, Valerie.
Hi, how are you?
Good, good. So why do you believe this plan is inadequate?
Well, there are a number of reasons why. Perhaps the best starting place is the fact that the whole concept of mitigation, I think, is a problematic one. It basically suggests that one can make up or compensate for damage caused in one area by preserving something someplace else. And so it doesn't really change the fact that the damage is occurring in the first place. But in this specific proposal here, there are a couple of problems with it. And first of all, I should say that we would certainly, you know, welcome any additional conservation easements in that area to protect additional land. Mm-hmm. That's not the issue. We would, you know, welcome properly done conservation easements. However, we don't think that what they're proposing as an exchange for destroying, you know, 28 plus acres of upland habitat is a good idea. In particular, though, that there are two pieces to the mitigation proposal that they're proposing, and one piece is especially bad from our perspective because it would actually undermine further protection for the marsh instead of adding protection. Mm-hmm. And that involves a proposed right-of-way, which would be a long, narrow strip of a right-of-way easement from Stillwater Avenue going way up into the marsh and would end in a small parking area, which they have initially proposed to pave. Now, the major problem with this is that the language of the easement contains all kinds of language permitting the extension of all kinds of utilities like, you know, gas, sewer, water, and telephone, electric pipelines, lines all the way up that road into the marsh area and being paved as well. And so it's pretty clear to us from looking at the language in that piece of it that they're really using that as a way of opening up that part of the marsh to further development, not protecting it at all. So, and the other piece, the other part of it that they're proposing right now involves about 29 acres or so to the kind of west side of the marsh, just north of the old BC Railroad bed. And we don't object to that being put under a conservation easement. However, we do object to that being seen as a swap or an exchange for destroying the piece where they want to build the widewaters. And finally, the additional protection they're offering there is not really what it seems, because that parcel kind of is a narrow strip that runs along the western side of the Panjajawak stream there. And about half of that piece would already be protected, actually, by existing environmental guidelines with the Inland Fisheries and Wildlife that mandates protection within 250 feet of a wetland edge. So the actual protection they're offering there is an additional maybe 12 or 14 acres, not 28 acres. But regardless, simply proposing that as efficient exchange or compensation for building the Super Walmart on this 28 or 29-acre parcel with all the damage that it could cause to the stream and to the wildlife of the marsh itself and the destruction of habitat is not a good deal, in our opinion.
And the DEP is having hearings last week in June?
Yes, actually it's the BEP, which is the Board of Environmental Protection, and they're having their hearings the last week in June. They're currently scheduled for June 26th and 27th, which is a Wednesday and a Thursday. And there will be a section for public testimony one of those evenings. We're not sure which yet. And the hearings will be in Bangor. We're not exactly sure yet where in Bangor, but they will be in Bangor. So we'll be encouraging people to show up to that.
And where can people get in touch with you for more information?
Well, they can call me, or they can send a letter, or send a question to our Bay Court address, which is Bay Court of 43 Columbia Street, Suite 32, and that's in Bangor 04401.
Suite 32, Bangor?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And is there a phone number as well, or
sure.
Do you prefer people write?
No, they can call me also. That's 947-0607. And I just wanted to add that we are actually involved in a really flurry of activity right now. We're very intensely involved in preparations for the BEP hearings with the legal help and working closely with the Maine Audubon Society and lining up expert witnesses and so on. So we are going to have to doing a fairly intense fundraising campaign as well over the next few weeks to help us gear up for this.
Great. Thank you very much, Valerie, for taking
you.
Time
thank
to update
you.
Us.
Sure. Thanks so much.
Bye.
Bye.
On May 24th, 1990, Earth First organizers and musicians Judy Berry and Daryl Turney were the victims of a bombing. The pipe bomb, which was wrapped in nails, exploded under Judy's driver's seat, nearly killing her and injuring Daryl Turney, her passenger. Judy Berry and Daryl Turney were well known and respected for their environmental, social justice, and labor activism. And in 1990, they were organizing Redwood Summer, a campaign of mass rallies in protest of the corporate logging of California's remaining redwoods. A few weeks before the car bombing, the FBI had been conducting a bombing training nearby in which they practiced blowing up cars. The training was held on Timber Company land. On the day Judy's car was bombed, the FBI were on the scene within minutes, almost, Judy said later, as if they were waiting around the corner with their fingers in their ears. The FBI told the Oakland Police Department that Judy and Daryl were terrorists. They refused to investigate death threats that the activists had received and instead arrested them while Judy was still in the hospital and charged them with accidentally blowing themselves up. The charges were later dropped for lack of evidence, but not before the FBI and OPD engaged in a national media smear campaign against Judy, Daryl, and Earth First. A year later, when it became clear to Daryl and Judy that no real effort was being made to solve the case, they filed a federal civil rights lawsuit against the FBI and the Oakland Police Department. The suit alleges a politically motivated conspiracy to smear and discredit Judy Berry, Daryl Turney, and Earth First by attempting to frame them and using false arrest and unlawful search and seizure in violation of their First and Fourth Amendment rights. Despite 11 years of defense motions and appeals which have dragged out the case, the court ruled that there was substantial evidence to support the charges, and a jury trial began last month in Oakland. It's expected to end today or tomorrow. Unfortunately, Judy Berry did not live to see justice in the case. She died of breast cancer in 1997. Shortly before her death, Judy said, quote, "This case is not just about me or Daryl or Earth First. This case is about the rights of all political activists to engage in dissent without having to fear the government's secret police," close quote. Joining us by phone today is Mainer Don Kimball. Don is a vegan, animal rights, anti-nuclear forest activist, and he was at some of the Redwood Summer events in 1990. Don has been active with the Sierra Club, Earth First, Sea Shepherd Society, PETA, People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Animal Protection of New Mexico, and the Southwest Forest Alliance, as well as the infamous Ancient Forest Bus Brigade, to name a few. Don's also a former air traffic controller, and he was active in organizing the National Air Traffic Controller Association Union and is currently a member of the Association of Flight Attendants Union. Don says that he is a big believer that jobs in the environment can coexist and that he believes, like Judy Berry, that we should build, not burn, bridges with workers and their unions. He believes that corporate America has taken over our government with NAFTA, GATT, etc., and that we need to work through nonviolent means to take it back and save what's left of this beautiful home we call Earth. Don has been attending the trial in California and joins us today to let us know how that's going. Welcome, Don.
Oh,
welcome. So they were scheduled to do closing arguments starting today, and the trial's been going on since the beginning of April, so I'm sure there's a lot to cover. Can you bring us up to date on what's been happening in the courtroom?
I'll do my very best. And first
Thanks.
Of all, I wanted to thank you both for having me on. And, you know, it's important for people everywhere to be able to be up to date on what's going on. And on behalf of Earth First and the Redwood Summer Justice Project, thank you.
Thank you.
For giving us this time.
Thank you.
I've been to the trials sporadically. I'm able to go out there because of my job as a flight attendant, and I just kind of schedule my trips to go out there. So I was able to be there for the first 4 days. I was there at the rally, the kickoff rally that we had, and that was just really, really great and inspiring. There was about 200 people outside the courthouse that rallied in support of Judy and Daryl. And then I've just, like I said, kind of been there sporadically ever since. Basically, what it's down to now, the closing arguments, and it's hard to say how it's gone, but I think one of the most significant factors is we finally had our day in court, and we were the plaintiffs, and they were the defendants finally. And hopefully this will set a trend. It was very inspiring, to say the least, to go into that courtroom, look over to my left, and see 6 FBI agents and 3 Oakland police officers up against the wall. Okay, now you guys are wrong, and you're going to have to pay for it, and you're going to have to, you know, tell your story in court. The judge has been, I think it's about as fair as possible, Claudia Wilkins. One of the major points that she did not let the lead attorney, Dennis Cunningham, bring up, although he did do his best to try, was COINTELPRO. And for people who aren't familiar with COINTELPRO, it's an FBI program that includes domestic surveillance harassment and has included people being assassinated. And these are nonviolent civil rights activists, political activists, environmental activists, what have you. Probably the most famous one that's still in jail that we all know and love and hope that he gets out is Leonard Peltier. This program was supposed to have been stopped, and in fact, people didn't even know it existed until, I don't know what year it was. I think it was in the mid-'80s some activists broke into...
71.
Was it that long ago? Yeah, broke into a FBI office, and I think it was somewhere in Pennsylvania, and stole all their files and found out this COINTELPRO program existed. Judge Claudia Wilkins did not allow that to be talked about in court, which is unfortunate. It was also unfortunate that she did not agree that Richard Held, who was in charge of the field office in San Francisco at the time of the bombing, was not brought in to testify because he really has been a COINTELPRO operative for quite a while, and we really wanted to get him into court, but unfortunately that didn't happen.
And
nevertheless,
he had been in charge of her case as well.
Yeah. Right. Nevertheless, we did, after all these years, finally get into the courtroom. It's been extremely inspiring. It's been moving. It's been it's sometimes very depressing. I happen to have been at the Redwood Summer Justice Project office when we went to move the car that was preserved, Judy's Subaru station wagon, over to a site where the jurors could come down and look at it. And seeing the car, seeing the damage firsthand, seeing where the holes were, because this is a big point of contention in the case, is where was the bomb placed?
And can you explain why that was a big bone of contention?
Originally, and the activist community has kind of got this wrong, and I had to learn when I was out there because we're not really good with legalese. Actually, Daryl and Judy were never actually charged with any crimes. They were arrested, but the district attorney refused to actually charge them, which was the next step after you're arrested, because there was insufficient evidence. And the big point of contention is, was the bomb underneath the seat? Or was the bomb in the back seat? If the bomb was underneath the seat, of course, Judy and Daryl had no knowledge of having that bomb. They were arrested for carrying an explosive device because the FBI, who showed up and, as you mentioned, was conducting car bombings on LP land just prior to...
Louisiana Pacific.
Yeah, sorry. Just prior to this bombing, showed up within about 10 minutes. It was just absolutely... It was too much of a coincidence, shall we say, that they were around, and they said that the bomb... was placed in the back seat, which, of course, those of us know that, Judy had been a nonviolent organizer for something like 20 years, and this a mother, and this was just not her style.
Right. They were claiming that it was placed, One of the reasons why it's important is because they're claiming that it was placed within full view, that it was placed on top of Judy's guitar and violin case, and they must have been able to see it when they got in the car or near them. So they must have been able to see it when they got in the car.
Right, and there's three different fail-safe devices on this bomb. There was a motion detector, there was an on-off switch, and there was something else, and I can't remember what it was. But, you know, even if somebody did have a bomb they were going to take somewhere, would they drive around with it armed? I mean, this is also a point. They also produced the jeans that Judy was wearing that day. And to see these shredded jeans and to see the holes in these jeans, and to hear the testimony of the doctors, Judy had 25 injuries to her, thoracic, abdominal area, pelvic area. And she had five injuries below that. She was severely, severely injured. And looking at the cars and looking at the pants, I mean, you could just, you know, it was just very, very moving. To see those, and basically Judy was targeted because she was effective. I mean, the timber companies were scared. They weren't scared that Judy and Daryl were violent. They were scared that they were organized, and they were very organized, and they were organizing the workers up in Northern California, the mill workers and the timber workers, the timber industry, to say, look, you know, this cycle of slash and burn and cut and run is not working for anybody except the timber barons. It's devastating the communities. Nobody has a job. The land's devastated. And Judy was really making a really big connection with the workers there, and that hadn't been done before. And this is one of the reasons I've stayed with this so long. I was there for a few events in 1990. I wouldn't call myself a major participant, but I did go. And one of the things that really spoke to me was going into these smaller communities and talking with the workers and saying, look, I'm a union person. You're a union person. We both believe in the same things with jobs and families and protecting the environment. We have more in common than we have different. The timber barons are trying to make us enemies. They're pointing the finger and saying, we're the enemy. We're the ones that are putting these people out of work. And, you know, it's just not true. Sustained yield, which is a term that's used in the forest industry, means when you start at cutting at point A, you get to Z. By the time you get back to A again, if I'm making myself clear, you can start harvesting again. This sustained yield was not going on. Redwood summer was basically a delaying action, if you will, because the Environmental Protection Information Center in Garberville, EPIC for short, wrote a forest initiative called Forest Forever, Proposition 130. That was going to be presented to qualified for the ballot, and in November, the voters of California were going to decide whether or not they wanted to protect California's forests.
This is back in 1990,
fall
after Redwood Summer, right?
And Judy came up with Redwood Summer to say, look, as soon as the timber companies knew this legislation was being written, they went out and started cutting crazy, as Daryl would say, clear cut to infinity. And Redwood Summer was an attempt to get activists in the woods through nonviolent means to stop the cutting, we knew we weren't going to stop it, but to slow it down as much as possible to save whatever we could. Now, unfortunately, Proposition 130 had a competing initiative against it. The timber company wrote they threw a lot of money, TV ads, campaigns at the very last minute. We lost by about, I think it was between 1.5% and 3% of the total votes. It was just... It was devastating, but Redwood Summer was an attempt to slow things down until Proposition 130 got in, and unfortunately, that didn't happen.
One of the other reasons why the lawsuit, or one of the instigating reasons for the lawsuit, was the fact that Judy and Daryl and others felt that once they stopped investigating Judy and Daryl, that no one was being investigated, despite the fact that there had been lots of death threats. Can you say more about that, you know, leading up to Redwood Summer, some of the threats that they were receiving?
Yeah, and there was some good news about that the DNA test proved that, I've got it right here, a Forensic Science Associates, a lab mutually agreed upon by the FBI and the Redwood Summer Justice legal team, has found that a police informant letter from someone calling himself Argus, this person tried to set up Judy Berry for arrest in 1989, was sealed by the exact same person who sent Judy her first death threat in April of 1990. The death threat said, "Judy Berry, get out and go back where you come from. We know everything. You won't get a second warning." So there's additional analysis going on right now, but that's the best lead in a long time for this bomber, because I believe you mentioned this, that, you know, the perpetrators of this crime were never seriously looked for, and that person is probably still out there.
In fact, they only were looking within the ranks, if you will, of other environmental activists. Rather than
that, I think, as excuse to investigate other environmentalists.
And this is one of the three things one of the three points that the plaintiffs have, which is false arrest, a violation of civil liberties, and when they couldn't assassinate Judy, they came and said, "Okay, we'll assassinate her character," is what Dennis Cunningham said, and it's true. You know, they tried to kill her, they couldn't, so they tried to assassinate her character and Earth's first character, and that's a violation of the First Amendment right to free speech. And, this FBI, Quantelpro, has continued. I worked, for the federal government for almost 20 years, and although in a different agency, you get your entrenched bureaucrats and things just don't change. And unfortunately, the FBI is an entrenched bureaucracy, and they also happen to have guns, weapons. And there's been legislation. I think a lot of activists out there in Maine know that there's been legislation that was proposed in Maine to even make nonviolent civil disobedience against the law.
Yes, the so-called anti-terrorism bill, of all things.
Mm-hmm. And right. There was just a House, the chair of the House Subcommittee on Forest and Forest Health, Representative Scott McGinnis, convened a congressional hearing in February of this year about eco-terrorism. The star witness was none other than James Jarboe, the FBI's domestic terrorism section chief, who named so-called eco-terrorists the number one domestic threat in the United States. So activists need to know that, you know, there's still a concentrated effort by the Department of Justice, and the FBI is part of, in harassing, intimidating activists. Unfortunately, 9/11 has not made things any better. The Patriot Act is an absolute abomination, and it makes me think of a quote by Thomas Jefferson that says, "Those who attempt to restrict order in the name of liberty deserve neither, and will lose both." Mm-hmm. And it's really, really serious what's going on out there, and that's why this case is so important, because we've finally got them in court, and we're going to hopefully win this case, and I don't know if we'll shut down Quantelpro, but we'll certainly make a big dent in it.
Well, as you mentioned earlier, they had said that this has to be about individual FBI agents, that they wouldn't actually let, the judge wouldn't actually let this be about COINTELPRO, and then I talked to somebody last night out in California who was saying that they had just caught wind of the possibility that the judge had granted the FBI agents who were testifying immunity. Have you heard anything about that?
No, I haven't, but I'll definitely be in touch with people tonight. I didn't hear that.
So if first they say we can't make it about the agency, it has to be about the individual agents, and then they grant immunity to the agents, then other than maybe getting Judy's fiddle back finally, and the moral victory of being proven correct, if the case is won, what would that mean in concrete terms?
Well, it is a civil case, so there's no criminal.
So there's no criminal effect anyway.
Right. Yeah. There's no criminal effect.
That would have to be another. I wonder how they would actually. So could she actually give them immunity in this case from later prosecution in another case?
I think we need a lawyer on the line. Yeah, I think that's probably what's going on. Although you got me off guard with that. I would like to just let people know, I don't know how much time we have left before.
Yeah, it's about time to wrap up.
We close. Okay, for folks who are interested in following the case, they can follow it on the web, www.judybarry, which is J-U-D-I-B-A-R-I.org. And you could call 707-887-0262. There is a rally planned on May 24th outside the federal courthouse. This will be the 12th anniversary of the bombing in Oakland. And, you know, it's a little tough for folks in Maine to get out there, but send your good energy that way.
Great. We should mention Judy has a book published before she passed away in 1994 by Common Courage Press called Timber Wars by Judy Barry.
And she, you know, I only got to meet Judy once, and that was in 1981. It was a follow-up called Ecotopia Summer. And she gave me a ride to a protest or an action or something. I think it was just her and I in the car, maybe her daughters were in the back. And we were talking a little bit, and I said to her, I said, Judy, I said, really, you're one of the bravest people I've ever met because you're still out here and you're still doing it. And she told me, I'm scared every day. And that stayed with me all these years. It stayed with me, and I'll never forget it. Nobody should have to be scared every day. Nobody who's trying to save Mother Earth should have to be scared every day. Nobody who's trying to protect jobs should be scared every day. And the FBI and this Department of Justice and our government need to know we are not the enemy.
Thank you, Don Kimball.
Thank you very much for joining us.
They said the reason they knew that the bomb was in the back seat where we could have seen it rather than hidden under my seat, as it actually was, is because they said that I had loaded my guitar case right on top of the bomb, and they said the guitar and the fiddle were both, like, right in the vicinity of the explosion. So lo and behold, we get back the pictures from the Oakland police, and here's the guitar. Now, it's certainly damaged, but not as if a bomb had been on top of it, and there's the fiddle. Virtually intact, okay? And I want to know, I've actually seen these things in the course of the case. We get to, like, look at the evidence, and it's actually really kind of sad. This was my childhood violin, and I opened the case, and it only had two cracks up the F-holes, and that's all. Whereas the guitar, which was in a cheap case, was kind of shattered. But at any rate, so in light of this, realizing that they took this fiddle, we wrote this song.
Well, I was driving out of Oakland on a tour for Redwood Summer when a bomb went off inside my car. It was a major bummer. They blamed me for the bomb that almost took my life. But there's one last thing that they did, one last twist of the knife. The FBI stole my fiddle.
They stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole
my fiddle. The FBI stole my fiddle. And I want my fiddle back. The next day in the papers, although it made no sense, was a picture of my fiddle, and they called it evidence. They took away my Birkenstocks, they took away my car. But when they took my fiddle, well, you know they went too far. The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle. And I want my fiddle back. They said my strings was fuses, my bow it was a lie. And down inside my fiddle hole I stashed my dynamite. So when I stroke my fuse strings with my fiddle bow, you better run for cover, cause this fiddle might just blow. The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle.
The FBI stole my fiddle. Special Agent Richard Held is the man behind the show. He helped frame Leonard Peltier and jail Geronimo. He falsified the evidence, life sentences, no bail. It's time to get them freed and let's put Richard Held in jail. The FBI stole my fiddle.
Richard Held stole my fiddle.
I stole my fiddle.
And that, of course, was Judy Berry and Daryl Turney. Judy never did get her fiddle back, and so far all efforts to get the FBI to release it to her children have been unsuccessful. You've been listening to Radioactive, a grassroots environmental and social justice news journal. I'm Amy Brown.
And I'm Meredith DeFrancesco.
We'd like to thank Joel Mann for engineering, Andy Buckley for web support, and you for listening and acting. You can contact us here at WERU or by emailing radioactivenews@hotmail.com. You can listen to archived Radioactive programs on our website, www.freespeech.org, or at mainindymedia.org. Please listen next Friday, May 24th, the 12th anniversary of the bombing, at 10 o'clock in the morning for an hour-long prison radio special called Judy Berry, Revolutionary Ecology. That's here on WERU next Friday, the 24th, at 10 o'clock.